You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
What's assassinating my John Liddens?
Why,
Sovi? Why did I say that?
I don't know.
Why would anyone say such a terrible thing? That's what I want to know.
Robert, I'm simply asking you why you would start, like, why?
I don't know. Nobody knows, Sovi. That's the most important thing, is that no one knows why things happen where they happen.
I disagree.
Or who they happen to. But this is Behind the Bastards podcast. Bad people. Tell you all about them. And normally, this is a podcast where I read a story about a bad person to somebody who's coming in cold. But today, I am the person who is chilly, who is coming in frigid, frost on my shoulders, as I talk to my good buddy, Chris. Chris, how are you doing?
Doing okay. It is thundering incredibly ominously, which I feel like is a good vibe for the story.
Yes. Oh, ominous thunder. Nothing better. Turn up your mic pickup. Let's get some of that on the line.
Yeah. It's like I can like feel stuff shaking a little bit. It is a pretty impressive thunder round.
Yeah. That's good. How are you? What are we today? What are we talking about? Who are we? Where are we?
Robert, we were told that after the war, the Nazis vanished without a trace. But battalions
that is what
of
I know
fascists,
about Nazis, that they went away forever after the war.
Still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell us of their defeat in 45. But Robert, why did they all come out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died? I've done my obligatory Chumbawamba, and so now I can answer this actual question.
You did. That was a good. That was a good Chumbawamba.
I liked it. Thanks, Chris.
I'm gonna have to wumba some chumbas later on here, but I'll let that be something that we build to.
The funny thing is, my favorite version of that song actually isn't the Chumbawamba version. It's the, what was it, the Stockholm's Women's Anti-Fascist Choir did a version of it that rules. Very good.
Oh, that does sound nice.
Yes, it was very exciting. And the other thing that's exciting is that the answer to that question is that it turns out after the day the Nazi died, the Nazis came out of the woodwork and they all joined the World Anti-Communist League.
And that is there the subject. There we go.
This is the subject of today's story.
These guys.
Oh, bunch of real freaks and weirdos. Now,
excellent.
Somewhat weirdly, for a story that is about a lot of Nazis, we're actually not starting in Germany. The actual story
That's fair.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the sort of consistent themes of this entire episode is stuff happening around the orbit of the Soviet Union. And so, I guess you could technically start the story in Ukraine, but I didn't do that. And instead, I'm starting it in China in the year 1923. And this is a year in which the Soviets are going to create a monster that will haunt them until the day the USSR collapses. And that monster is called the KMT, or the Chinese Nationalist Party.
Mm.
Now, okay, people who know the history of this are going to be like, Chris, have you lost your mind? What do you mean the Soviets created the KMT? And the answer is yes, I have lost my mind, but it is for reasons that are completely unrelated to this.
It's for reasons that are related to the Daily Show we all agreed to do.
Yeah, that. Yeah. And also this episode. But yes, the Daily Show,
what a good idea that was.
I genuinely
a idea. Love it.
Cannot believe I was sober while I agreed to that. Incredible. Genuinely baffling decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm very happy we got multiple other people brought on to deal with that problem we created for ourselves.
Now that it was,
I was going to say, yeah. Robert and I were not sober when we agreed to that deal.
Oh, I mean,
that explains a lot.
I was sober last in 2009. So anyway, maybe 2010. Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty recent. So we've actually talked about this period all the way back in the episode about the Chinese warlord period that I did. So the Nationalist Party, or the KMT, is by Chinese standards, even in 1923, they're a pretty old political formation by Chinese standards. It's founded in 1894 by Sun Yat-sen, but by 1923.
Oh wow, I had no idea it went back that far.
Yeah, well, it's kind of weird. So it's there are two different dates you see about it founded. There's one date where Sun Yat-sen starts an organization and it joins another organization. But yeah, it's really the oldest of the sort of continuous Chinese revolutionary groups that come out of the sort of pre-overthrow of the Qing Dynasty era. And, you know, it does a lot of stuff. They do a bunch of revolutions, but by 1923, they're just a disaster. They're a complete mess. They're an organizational mess. They're a political mess. Militarily is a mess. Financially is a mess. This is supposed to be a mass political party, right? They're trying to take over all of China. They don't even have a newspaper. This is China's Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And the USSR, having failed in their attempt to sort of bring revolution to the West via the Red Army storming through Eastern Europe, the consequences of which we will get back to in a second, the USSR sort of turns its attention east. And Sun Yat-sen and the Bolsheviks come to an agreement in which the Soviets start sending advisors and weapons to arm the KMT in their war against the sort of Chinese warlords. And chief among those people is a guy named Mikhail Borodin. Actually, I don't know if it's Michael or Mikhail. Probably should have figured that out.
If they're Russian, you always say Michael is Mikhail. Yeah.
Mikhail Borodin,
that's a Russian ash name.
He's
Mikhail Borodin. Yeah, that's a good one. Mm-hmm.
He's the Bolsheviks' Bolshevik. Very, very old school. Guy who left the Bund and joined the Bolsheviks in 1903.
Yeah.
He has this impeccable sort of revolutionary credentials.
Yeah, and smelled Lenin's morning breath, that close.
Yeah. And he is about to make one of the worst mistakes the USSR has ever made, which is pretty impressive if you look at the history of the USSR.
Which includes the largest lake in the world that they killed.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And this one, it probably killed more people than losing that lake, which is...
Yeah, look, I'm a big believer that fuck lakes, fuck them all, kill every lake.
I mean, look, hey, you too can become the Soviet Union, wage a protracted people's war against lakes.
Exactly. This is my opinion. When the revolution comes, the first thing we need to deal with is not the fascists. You know, it's not like control of the far right in Florida or wherever. We got to nuke the Great Lakes. Not the cities. We got to nuke the lakes themselves. It's the only thing that's going to protect us. Sophie,
no.
I know what you're going to say, but I need you to listen to a song called The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald by Gordon Lightfoot. And then tell me those lakes don't have some vengeance coming.
We're not blowing up the lakes.
We could.
We shouldn't.
New slogan, a nuke for every lake.
A nuke for every lake.
Christopher, do not take his side.
Mm-hmm. Fuck them lakes. That is the official stance of Cool Zone Media on the Great Lakes.
I like watching explosions.
Nuke the lakes. Yeah, absolutely. It would be good for everybody. It'll bring in tourism. to whatever cities people have on those fucking lakes, it'll be good for people. Sophie. Yeah.
No.
That's just science.
Absolutely.
That's just
not.
Mathematics.
The spit is going on so long. Please, please save us from this, Chris.
So speaking of saving people from things, so Borodin, with Sun Yat-sen's sort of help and approval, turns the KMT into like a modern mass political party with this sort of centralized organization and the centralized political apparatus. They get an actual like ideology. And as is going to become very important later on in the story, the party starts to develop political and ideological discipline. As part of this effort, the nationalists send Chiang Kai-shek to the USSR to study Soviet military and ideological techniques. And when he comes back, they put him in charge of a sort of new Soviet-style military academy, from which he is going to build an absolutely enormous power base in the army because he's the guy who is now training all of the officers. But the Soviets are like, no, this is fine. They call him the Red General. Like, Chiang Kai-shek like shakes hands with Stalin, and everything seems to be going great, except there's one minor problem here. Chiang Kai-shek is not a communist. He is not a leftist at all. He's like, basically he's a gangster who's like kind of nationalist. Now, the other thing that's extremely bad about all of this is that Sun Yat-sen dies in 1925. And Chiang Kai-shek is pretty rapidly able to take control of the party. Now, and the other thing that's happening here is that even by sort of Soviet standards, right? I mean, this is pre-Stalin, like, fully taking control. So even by Soviet standards, the new sort of KMT organization is incredibly centralized. And the person at the top of it has an enormous amount of political power. And so, you know, Chiang Kai-shek takes over the party, and he also sort of personally commands the loyalty of this new generation of officers who've been trained by the Soviets. He has a bunch of Soviet weapons. And, you know, the result of this is that he now has the best army of any Chinese political faction. And what has happened here is that the Soviets have, in essence, like, they have built a party in their own image, right? They've built this party that's designed with this sort of, like, ruthless efficiency and stamping out kind of revolutionaries. And they have handed it to a fanatical anti-communist drug lord who immediately turns around and uses it to massacre, like, the entire Chinese urban working class and the first of his white terrors.
Now, that seems bad for organizing.
Yeah, it's not good. And my favorite part, I think I told the story in the last episode. My favorite part about this, though, is that, like, okay, so Chiang Kai-shek is, like, killing the communists, right? It's like in 1927, and the communists are like, they go to the Soviet Union. They're like, hey, what should we do? And the Soviet Union is like, they're having some kind of, like, Trotsky and Stalin are having some kind of argument. And the line that comes out of them is like, well, you guys have to, like, stay allied with this party that is murdering you. And it was just like, and then they all die, right? He kills something like a million people.
Okay, so that's a pretty serious set of crimes against humanity there.
Yeah, it's really bad. And this is the Soviets doing great stuff. But, you know, okay, so Chiang Kai-shek kills about a million people trying to wipe out the Chinese left. But we can ask ourselves another question, which is, how did this actually go for Chiang Kai-shek in the long term? And this is a question that can be answered by answering the very simple question, Robert, who actually won the Chinese Civil War?
Was it China?
Technically?
Mm-hmm. So it went well.
Yeah, it went great. Yeah, uh-huh. This is why Taiwan and China are currently one country run by the Chinese National Party.
By the same government, yes.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's great.
I mean, if you listen to America for roughly a generation and a half, Taiwan is China and the only Chinese government that we need to worry about.
Yeah, we will come back to that, because that turns out to be a thing in this story. But, you know, so Chiang Kai-shek, like, the net effect of Chiang Kai-shek's, like, incredibly vehement anti-communism is that he creates another monster who is going to absolutely destroy him. That person, of course, being Mao Zedong. And, you know, when you sort of, like, take kind of macro view of this, right, this whole thing is a cycle, right? The Bolsheviks are the monster that sort of capitalism unleashed when they crushed the Paris Commune. The Bolsheviks create the modern KMT, and the KMT, you know, like, slaughters the entire urban, like, Chinese Communist Party, and they, you know, they unleash another monster by turning the CCP into the sort of the peasant army that Mao is going to use to crush the KMT themselves after World War II. But, you know, the problem here, and the problem for this story, is that Mao didn't actually finish off the KMT. That, you know, they retreat to Taiwan after losing the Civil War. And they're able to do this because in 1947, the KMT forces that were occupying Taiwan do what they call the February 28th incident, And it's kind of complicated. We will one day do a full thing on this, but the basics of it is there's an uprising in Taiwan against the sort of brutality of the KMT occupation. And the KMT kills something like 20,000 people in a week. And this is like, you know, this is a genuine horror, right? Like they're beheading students.
That is
in the
a
street.
Lot of people to kill in a week.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
I could kill maybe 5,000 people in a week.
Yeah. I mean, you have
with
to
with the
be,
resources
have be,
we have here at Cool Zone Media. Yeah. Tops 5,000.
I think you can do 5,000. I think if we pull everyone else together, we can get that number up to maybe 7.
Yeah.
We have a lot of staff now.
Yeah. We do have a lot of staff now. Sophie, can we get some of the numbers people to just run that by? So we have some options on the table.
Sure, Robert.
Okay. Thank you, Sophie.
Yeah. So the KMT is like they're like cutting people, like cutting parts of people's faces off and like taking them. It's really bad. Right. This is basically like the foundational like crime of modern Taiwanese political history. And there's like a huge portion of like all of the politics that are going to happen in Taiwan from then until like now are in large part because of this. And if you read books about Chiang Kai-shek, like, well, the books that are not about Chiang Kai-shek, but where like Chiang Kai-shek shows up for some reason, this is like the crime that they always talk about. And, you know, it is really bad. But the thing you have to understand about Chiang Kai-shek is that like, this is probably not even in his top 10 war crimes. Like, this is a man who once killed 400,000 civilians by blowing up a single dam. After the February 28th incident, Taiwan until like the 90s is under this thing called the White Terror, where, you know, the government disappears a bunch of people, they kill a bunch of people, they torture a bunch of people. But the thing is, again, this is his second White Terror, right?
Man.
And yeah.
That's something he and I have in common, because that's what people call me when I've had a couple too many. Can you tell me that much, huh?
You know, actually, I feel like I should actually have looked into Chiang Kai-shek's drug use more, because this guy is running a lot of drugs. But, you know, but the thing about these White Terrors, right, is that like, okay, the White Terror that he does in Taiwan is like a genuine horror, right? It's also, he kills something like a 25th of the people that the first White Terror killed. Like,
well, that's,
this guy,
that's good. So he's moving in the right direction. A couple more terrors and he won't be killing anybody at all.
Well, I mean, the thing that Chiang Kai-shek does, we're going to see in the story, is that he stops. Okay, he doesn't stop killing people in Taiwan, but like the number of people he kills in Taiwan go down over time. The number
that's
of people
good.
He
so,
kills.
Okay, that's progress.
Yeah, this is sort of a win. But the number of people he kills in every other country just starts like rapidly increasing as time goes on.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to kill the people somewhere. So I feel like. Still progress.
Yeah, we're only going to do a soft White Terror in Taiwan, and we're going to do a hard White Terror in Guatemala. So, you know, and like I think the thing with Chiang Kai-shek, right, is the reason he's not remembered as one of the sort of like great historical monsters. Like, again, this is a guy like killing 20,000 people in a week is like Tuesday for Chiang Kai-shek. And like the only reason he's not remembered as this sort of like monster is that he's overshadowed once again by like the sort of the trio quad thing of Mao, Stalin, Hitler, and Churchill.
Yeah, there's a lot of people doing, like, he killed a million people, and that's pretty good numbers any other year.
I mean, he's probably like, got, like, yeah, I mean, he's probably got, like,
million?
3 or 4 million, yeah.
Which, and that's solid, like, look, don't get me wrong, solid numbers, historically, like, if you're 3-4 million dead, pretty good, you're doing real good as a war criminal on a historic level. But man, first half of the 20th century, that shit doesn't even get you on the board.
No, like, you're like a C-lister. It's
the LeBron Jameses of genocide are out in the streets in those days. And there's a lot of them. Like, this fucking Scottie Pippen ass mass murder ain't gonna cut it. How was that, Sophie? Was that a good basketball?
I mean, it depends on who you're asking, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Acceptable, but very subjective.
Mm-hmm.
I approve.
Scottie Pippen was the only other basketball player I could think of. I assume he's not as good as LeBron James.
I mean, he would say he is, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so would Chiang Kai-shek, but sorry, bro.
I mean, look, the thing with Chiang Kai-shek is that Chiang Kai-shek has the ability to shoot you if you don't agree with him. I don't think Scottie Pippen has the ability to sort of like mobilize an entire death squad apparatus to make everyone think that he's better than LeBron James.
No. The only basketball player who had a solid death squad apparatus was, of course, Shaq.
Are we just going to see how many basketball players you can remember? I liked it. I mean, it also, once again, did work.
Thank you. I recently watched the new Adam Sandler basketball movie, so I'm very knowledgeable about basketball. What was funny about that, Sophie, is like every third second in that movie, somebody comes on screen and I can tell whenever they come on that, like, oh, that's a famous basketball guy. And I'm supposed to have a reaction to the fact that he's in this movie, too. But it means nothing to me every time.
Yeah, you didn't have me there to be like, that's who that is. And you're going, I don't care. And then
that's
moving Blumisma, on.
Blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the best. Touchdown. Go Patriots.
You were doing so well. Okay. Also, that's look. Yeah. Don't ever say that in front of Chris, by the way. Chris really hates the Patriots.
I will go back to my Taiwanese roots and Kavita death squad over this.
Yeah, I don't know if you knew this about Chris, but Chris really fucking hates the Patriots.
Well, guess no one's gonna be doing a hole in one. I don't know.
Wow. Brave.
Let's get back to the story. Yep.
So Chiang Kai-shek, in a lot of ways, is he is incredibly ahead of his time.
Yeah.
Okay, you can talk about sort of the periods of anti-communism, right? And, you know, he has this problem that he's working in a period of anti-communism in which the Nazis exist. And, you know, while the Nazis are around, the Nazis are sort of like the top dog of anti-communism. Although Chiang Kai-shek was allied with the Nazis. And he, like sure. his son was in the Weimar, and he almost led troops into Poland. And the only reason he didn't was that he got pulled back to Taiwan to like fight off the Japanese.
Yeah,
but you know,
yeah, I mean, this is one of the eras of Nazi history that people don't get enough, which is that like while Nazis are pretty much tied directly into like white supremacist shit today. The OG Nazis were extremely willing to work with people who were from a variety of different like ethnic groups and including fight with them. There was an Indian and Pakistani military unit in the SS because, again, racism changes over time like everything else and innovates.
Yeah, I mean, like I've talked about this before, but like, yeah, there were Nazi military advisors like leading Chinese troops in the Battle of Shanghai. And it's very weird. But, you know, Chiang Kai-shek, like, he loses this war, but he really has the prototype for the sort of second phase of anti-communism, which is that if you look at the KMT, right, it has an incredibly centralized ideological party apparatus. It has a bunch of death squads and is funding itself as an anti-communist dictatorship via the drug trade. So he is like 40 years ahead of everyone who is doing anti-communism. And so two of the two journalists whose book I'm going to be using for a lot of this, Scott and John Lee Anderson, they're two journalists who grew up in Taiwan under the military dictatorship. And they call this model of anti-communist party the death squad party for reasons that we will see shortly. And yeah, they're going to spend a lot of time exporting this to other places. Now, what's sort of interesting is that Chiang Kai-shek was like hated by like every American officer who had to interact with him during World War II. Which, like, no shit. Like, yeah, me too, buddy. I also hate this guy, but I'm admittedly biased because his government tried to publicly execute one of my great uncles.
Okay, well, what was your great uncle doing, though? How was he dressed?
He was dressed pretty well. There's a long story about what exactly happened there, but, and he did in fact survive.
That's
However,
good.
I'm still holding it against him for trying to publicly execute him.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's weird. So while the Civil War is going on and during World War II, everyone hates him. But the moment he loses the Civil War, he becomes the cause celeb of what's called the China Lobby in the U.S., where these like hardline anti-communists whose things that they want to like help Chiang Kai-shek in his just incredible delusion that one day he's going to like invade China again and retake the homeland. Like, and like the government in Taiwan made my mom, who was like five, sing songs about how they were going to reclaim the motherland one day. It was just
good.
Yeah. This place is like it is a just sort of incredibly neurotic, like sort of totalitarian military dictatorship.
Yeah. I mean, first off, squad goals. But yeah, that sounds like it could be a problem to live under.
Yeah, but like the people who backed him, of course, are the best and brightest of the people in American politics. You have Douglas MacArthur.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a good one. right? This is fresh after he attempted to start a nuclear war in order to distract from the fact that he had completely fucked the war in Korea.
Yep. There's another very famous person you probably know, Joseph McCarthy, better known for other works.
Yeah. Oh God. Of course. Yeah. Joe McCarthy, Slick Joe, known for
great guy.
Nothing bad. Yeah. Nothing,
yeah.
Great.
And so the KMT and their American allies start like looking for other sort of like fanatical anti-communists to like enlist their cause. And this search eventually leads them to the formation of the World Anti-Communist League. One of the people who they find is Park Chung-hee, he's the second military dictator of South Korea. And I keep saying we're going to do an episode about him one day, and I promise we will. But
there's so much wild ass, especially in this period, Korean history that people in the United States don't know fuck all about. It's really good, real good shit.
This guy, this is a guy who fought for the Japanese in World War II. And okay, there are a lot of Japanese people who were forced, who were, like, conscripted into fighting the Japanese army.
Sure, it was a military dictatorship. Yeah, that's the way it goes.
Park Chung-hee is not one of those guys. He fought for the Japanese Empire because he loved, from pure ideology, he was like, he looked at the Japanese Empire and was like, oh shit, I love this. And, you know, like, he is incredibly fascist. Like, this is the guy who Nobusuke Kishi talked to after the war and was like, whoa, buddy, you gotta tone the fascism shit down a little bit. Like, it's wild. And you know, but utterly inexplicably, this is the second communist decision in this episode that I'm just like, what are you guys doing? The communists let him join the Communist Party. And this is like baffling to me, right? Like, here is a dude who literally fought for the Japanese on purpose. And, you know, the Communist Party looks at him and goes like, what should we do with him, boss? I know, let's let him in the party. And so he, like, immediately gets arrested. And just instantly, like, the fastest ratting I've ever seen in my entire life, just, like, rats on his comrades to the government. Which, I am in principle against snitching. I also like really don't understand what the communists were expecting was going to happen here. Like, you brought in a guy who fought for the Japanese army on purpose. Of course, he was instantly going to betray you. Like, really? It's baffling stuff.
Yeah.
The Korean communists. But so in 1961, he coups the government, and he's the guy who like really fully brings Korea on board with this whole sort of like World Anti-Communist League thing. He starts sending like generals and like KCIA guys to the league. The Moonies are also a big part of this. I'm not going to talk about them here because
we have talked about the Moonies a lot.
Yeah.
Go listen to a lot and then make your own electronically fired blunderbuss. That's the official stance of this show.
They deserve it. So the other major group that's involved in the creation of the World Anti-Communist League is called the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or the ABN. And the ABN are a bunch of people who they're united by like two things. One is that they really hate the Soviets. The second thing they're united by is that they did the Holocaust.
Okay. So, well, that's bad. Yeah.
Yeah. The ABN was founded by a guy named Yaroslav Stetsko, who I think if you've been like looking into Ukrainian history in the last like, you know, year, you might know who this guy is. He's the guy who was chosen by Stefan Bandera to be the second in command of newly formed Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists.
I'm glad that didn't wind up going anywhere.
Oh yeah, no. It completely stalled out. They never ended up fighting.
Things are fine.
Everything's great. Look, like they did not end up fighting for the Nazis during Operation Barbarossa. Stetsko does not walk into the city of Lvov alongside a bunch of guys from the Weimark and immediately start doing the Holocaust. None of this ever happened. They didn't kill 7,000 people in like, I think a week. Most of whom were Jewish.
I mean, honestly, compared to Kai-shek numbers, that's rookie.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's weird because in any other group of people, like this guy is, you know, a world historical monster. He's kind of on the B team in terms of like the people in this episode, maybe the C team. So the thing that he does is he gets into Lvov and he immediately declares like a new independent Ukrainian state with him as a leader. And I'm just going to read from the speech that he gave when he was declaring this independent Ukrainian state. The Ukrainian state will closely cooperate with great National Socialist Germany, which under the leadership of Adolf Hitler will create a new order in Europe and throughout the world. the Ukrainian army will fight together with the Allied German army for the new order in the world.
Well, it didn't quite happen. So that's
It doesn't happen for two reasons. One is that the Nazis lose. Two is that he instantly gets arrested because the Nazis were like, hey, you guys didn't tell us that you were going to declare an independent state. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah. We don't want there to be a Ukraine.
Yeah, no.
this is something we're in agreement with the Russians about, actually.
Yeah,
we don't want this country to exist.
Yeah. And you know, so he gets thrown in prison and Stetsko, after the war, he will claim that, like, he was put in a concentration camp and the Nazis, like, persecuted him. And, like, this is kind of true, but, like, okay, so the thing that they put him under is called, quote, honorary arrest.
Yeah.
And he's, like, he's in, like, the nice prison, and they let him out, like, a few times, like, while this is going on, so he can coordinate more stuff. And in 1944, they let him out just, like, entirely because the war is going so badly, they were like, screw it, let's throw the Ukrainians at the Russians. And he and Bandera form this thing called the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, which fights the Red Army. And they also do some, like, incredibly half-assed fighting of the Nazis, which was, like, largely, as best I could tell, this largely seems to be so they could, like, say that we fought the Nazis. I'm going to read a passage here from the book, Transnational Anti-Communism in the Cold War, about what happened next. At the end of 1943, in the forest of, oh God, I don't know how to pronounce this, Jotomir, Gazalia, the western part of Ukraine, these same Ukrainian nationalists held the first clandestine congress of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the ABN, creating at the same time the Ukrainian National Army, the UPA. The UPA then took part in attacks on the retreating Weimar, while at the same time harassing the Red Army, the communist partisans, and Jewish citizens due to their suspected communist sympathies. The UPA, consisting of around 70,000 guerrillas, were joined by fragments of the SS's Ukraine, Belarusian, Russian, and Cossack battalions, as well as Hungarian, Romanian, Soviet, Baltic, and Georgian deserters. Now, the author is being, like, a bit too kind to the UPA here. The main reason that they are, quote, harassed Jewish citizens is because, like, an enormous number of these are just people are just, like, fanatical anti-Semites. But this is the birth of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. And again, like, Stetsko, this is a guy who fought for the Nazis. He probably has the lowest body count of the next, like, four groups I'm going to talk about. Also in the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, something called the Croatian Liberation Movement. The Croatian Liberation Movement was led by a guy named Stefan Heffer, who formed it alongside Ante Pavlovic, who is the founder of the Ustasha. Now, the Ustasha are they're a Croatian fascist organization that fought alongside the Nazis, and were given control of a new sort of Croatian fascist puppet state with Anton Pavlovic as its leader. Here's from the Holocaust Museum about what happened next at a concentration camp called Chudosovic. Oh, I did learn how to pronounce it, and then I immediately forgot.
Yeah. Like, look, Genosovic? There's a lot of concentration camps.
Yeah, well, this is the third largest camp in Europe. This is from the Holocaust Museum. Between its establishment in 1941 and its evacuation in April 1945, Croat authorities murdered hundreds of thousands of people at Jelosevic. Among the victims were between 45,000 and 52,000 Serbian residents of the so-called independent state of Croatia, between 12,000 and 20,000 Jews, between 15,000 and 20,000 Roma, between 5,000 and 12,000 ethnic Croats and Muslims who were political opponents of the regime. The Croat authorities murdered between 320,000 and 340,000 ethnic Serb residents of Croatia and Bosnia during the period of Ustasha rule. More than 30,000 Croatian Jews were killed either in Croatia or at Auschwitz. And to put this into perspective, that is over 75% of, like, all Croatian Jews who were killed by the Ustasha during the Holocaust. And the thing about this camp is that, like, unlike the rest of the concentration camps in Europe, they don't have gas chambers. They are doing all of these killings by hand. And it's not just that they're doing this by hand. I'm going to read this thing from the Jerusalem
Post.
Yeah, I
mean, that's the fucking Ustasha. Yeah.
Yeah. The late Jasa Alemani, who served as president of the Belgrade Jewish community, described Jasovic as barbaric, saying that the murders were predominantly carried out manually. Very seldom did they use bullets, he said, because they believed the victims didn't merit it. Almuni described some of the Ustashi's methods, which included cutting the eyes out of their victims and slitting their throats, throwing live prisoners into brick furnaces, and poisoning children. And, you know, you've talked a lot on this show about how the Nazis, like, were trying to execute Jews by firing squad, and they couldn't psychologically handle it. And that, you know, that's why we have the gas chambers. The Ustashi can do this.
Yeah.
Like, they keep doing this through the entire war.
Yeah. There's one of the many stories about the Holocaust that isn't told enough is that, like, the actual German SS were not nearly the most brutal war criminals on the Nazi side. The Ustashi is fucking nightmare people. And others, yeah. like, if you look at what's happening in the fucking Balkans during this period of time, like, yeah. what's going down and what becomes Serbia and Bosnia, and how the genocides are being conducted there by Nazi allies, like, it's a lot of the same thing, which is like, oh, we'll just strangle people. We'll just cut their yeah. heads off by the thousands. Like, we don't need to waste bullets on this shit. We don't need gas chambers. Like, as is often the case in wars, like, the nastiest fucking shit happens in these places like the Balkans and chunks of Eastern Europe that and with soldiers from those areas where, like, there's already, when the war hits, kind of a heightened level of acceptance of violence just because of shit in the recent past. And, like, the most nightmare stories come from a lot of those places kind of on the fringes of the Nazi power.
Yeah, and the Ustasha gets to a point where, like, there are instances where, like, the Nazis disband their units because they look what they're doing and they're like, hey guys, like,
yeah,
you're a bit far.
Well, here. I mean, there's a number of things because, like, again, it's bad for morale. Like, Nazis are complaining about what some of these units are doing.
Yeah,
this isn't what soldiers do, right? Is the attitude some folks have? Like, it's a mess.
And so Stefan Heifer, who he's going to become an important world anti-communist leader and a member of the sort of anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations.
He seems like a good guy.
He was the governor general of Baranja County in the new Nazi Croatian state. And yeah. Anton Pavlovic, who's again the founder of the Ustashi, is one of the founders of the Croatian Liberation Movement, which is the Croatian representative at the ABN. It's great.
Cool. Yeah. Do you know what else went on to have careers?
It's great. Do you know what else is great, Robert?
Is it products and services, Chris?
Yeah, let me tell you,
confusingly, we are sponsored by the Ustashi. A lot of people will say, why are you sponsored by the Ustashi? And I'll say, you should check out their promo code. How are we doing, Sophie?
No words. No words.
I've got nothing.
Not happy about that.
I just got nothing. All right.
Well, that happened. Here's ads. Robert Evans here. And as a kid, I loved playing Monopoly, but my favorite thing about it was robbing the bank, you know, working with my friends to pull over a con on somebody else, even heisting their money sometimes. And now Monopoly Go brings that fun to your phone. It's one of those games that can bring out the most devious version of ourselves. You can bankrupt your friends by pulling heists on their vaults and even use a wrecking ball to shut down their monuments. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with your friends to unlock prizes or try to top the leaderboards. And whether you're working with somebody or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is a huge blast. Go download it now for free on the App Store or Google Play. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So, for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. What's the catch? There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/behind. That's mintmobile.com/behind. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/behind. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Oh, yes. All right.
So meanwhile, the Romanian delegation of the ABN is a bunch of people from the Iron Guard, who is a Romanian fascist organization that did this during a fascist uprising in 1941. A mob of several hundred attacked the Sephardic temple, American correspondent Leigh White reported at the time, smashing its windows with stones and battering down its doors with lengths of timber. Mm. All objects of ritual prayer books, shawls, talmuds, Torahs, altar benches, and tapestries were carried outside and piled into a heap, which is soaked in gasoline and set afire. A number of Jewish pedestrians were herded together and forced to dance in a circle around the bonfire. When they dropped in exhaustion, they were doused in gasoline and burned alive. And I cut the description off. It gets way worse after that.
Yeah, if doused in gasoline and burned alive is like
that's
start
a mild
of the
stuff.
Ramp up. Yeah, it's that's like, before we it, really put our foot on the gas.
It gets like they are. All I will say about that is they are incredibly incredibly specific in how they use their anti-Semitism to kill people. It's like it's stuff you couldn't write a serial killer doing because. Yeah. And this is the Romanian delegation to the ABN. Belarus's delegation is called the Belarusian Liberation Movement. Its representative is a guy named Dmitry Kazmovich, who was appointed by the Nazis as the chief of police of Smolensk, where he exterminated Jews and communists.
Smolensk.
And he also joined an SS commando unit to fight the Soviets and was eventually smuggled out of a refugee camp by British intelligence and worked for the American army.
Oh, good.
It's great. And yeah, he founded this entire thing as a way to spy on the Soviets for the US. And at this point, we should mention that like this entire like just literal group of people who did the Holocaust is funded by both the US and the UK. The ABN is like all over American politics. Like they successfully lobbied the US into doing this thing that like I'm pretty sure by the time this comes out, Biden will have also done his version of it, which is called a Captive Nation Week. Which is like all presidents still do this to this day. It's supposed to be this thing that like honors nations held captive by authoritarian governments.
Oh, that's nice. It's the political equivalent of the like slapping a drowning handmaid. There you go, yeah. Kurds.
Well, and I also like I really want to like just take a moment to appreciate that the United States government, which is a state that literally holds hundreds of indigenous nations captive and occupies their land, declares Captive
Since
Nations
when?
Week since the 1600s.
And that doesn't sound like the America I learned about in Texas.
Yeah, no. And again, like they do this because some dipshits from the Ustashi told them 70 years ago.
Well, it's I'm great. Glad that our honor of captive nations is the honor of the captive nations of racists in particular. That's good.
Yeah.
It's
also fun because if you look at the declarations of this, the only states that are like ever mentioned are states that can be like somehow vaguely tied to communism. So like,
yeah.
You know, they'll talk about like, we need to free
the
people of
Cuba. Oh, I bet these guys
Cuba.
Had a fucking hard on for Rhodesia.
Oh yeah. 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 And even Biden released like his statement last year. It talks about Nicaragua, it talks about like Cuba, it literally no mention whatsoever of Saudi Arabia, which again, in my lifetime has invaded what, at least two, possibly three countries on top
that
of just being
sound
Saudi
like
Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, that doesn't sound like the country that Joe Biden would fist bump. Come
yeah,
on.
No. So the ABN starts working.
I am
with
now
Chiang
imagining
Kai-shek.
Joe Biden fist bumping a Ustashi militant. That's good. Yeah.
Reagan got pretty close.
Yeah,
like, Reagan
did get close.
Like,
Reagan did get close. I don't know. Biden's a 50-50 on that shit. The only thing he's consistently good on is hating the British, which
that's
I do
true.
Respect.
I do
respect that
appreciate
about him.
This. So the ABN starts talking with Chiang Kai-shek through a bunch of contacts, and they help train Taiwan's secret police, and they also help set up Radio Free Asia, which is incredibly fun. Now, contact between the ABN and the Taiwanese government leads to a 1966 meeting of Chiang Kai-shek's Asian People's Anti-Communist League in Seoul, South Korea, with representatives of sort of the whole global anti-communist movement comes together to do something. And 170 representatives from 60 nations show up. And what's interesting about this the interesting thing here is this isn't all fascist. The very first meeting where they're trying to figure out who, what is going to happen, who's going to be in this. There are social democrats who show up to this. There are regular conservatives, and all of these people immediately get run out. There's this group called the Assembly of Captive European Nations who they're not great people, but they also can't verify they didn't literally do the Holocaust, but they aren't literally the leaders of the Ustashi. And yeah, they try to become
not literally running a group so bad that the SS was occasionally might need to pump them brakes.
the bar for anti-communism is the bar of how bad you have to be for the anti-communists not to accept you is really, really, really low. And these people keep tripping over it, and and these guys are
I cannot emphasize enough that the dudes we're talking about are quite literally people that Heinrich Himmler would read reports about what they were doing and need to have a stiff drink.
and these guys, so the sort of moderates try to become the delegations from Eastern Europe, and the ABN just runs them out because the ABN's already tight with the Taiwanese, and the Taiwanese are one of the major sort of power blocks here. And the result of this is that, from the formative meeting of the World Anti-Communist League, this is just going to be a fascist organization. And, so we've now met two of the three sort of main power blocks in the World Anti-Communist League, right? There's the East Asian bloc centered around Taiwan and South Korea. And they have support from South Vietnam and Singapore and the Philippines. But yeah, the core there is sort of Taiwan and South Korea. There's the ABN fascists in Europe who are, again, the Ustashi and the Iron Guard and their people. And now it's time to meet group number three. This is the Latin American Anti-Communist Confederation, or CAL. CAL is originally a front group for a group called Los Tecos, who are a fascist death squad from the Autonomous University of Guadalajara.
Oh, Mexican fascists.
Oh, yeah. Well, these guys are great. So the modern iteration of Tecos was founded by a guy named Carlos Cuestra Gallardo, who is a Mexican Nazi who was doing something in Berlin during World War II. We don't know what. There are various rumors, some of them including him being part of the group who decides on the final solution. We don't know. There's rumors he was Hitler's secretary. It's very unclear. He's doing something to support the Nazis.
Hitler. He's woke Hitler, hiring people from all backgrounds.
Look, if these guys are
Stan and integration focused king. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All you have to do is be so unfathomably anti-Semitic that even the other anti-Semites eventually are you guys are too much. You can't say this out loud. And so he survives the war and he goes back to Mexico to help establish this network of fascist Mexican priests who hide people from the Iron Guard and other fascist collaborators. And these guys breathtakingly anti-Semitic.
There's the liberation theology priests, and then there's
who they start killing very quickly. And these guys are they're convinced that the UN is a Jewish conspiracy. They rave constantly about Marxists, the Zionists, and the Freemasons. And they also think that Vatican II, where the church taxed a bit to the left, is a good enough reason to just literally start killing Catholic priests, even though, again, all of these people are Catholics.
A bit to the left, all they did was change the fucking liturgy to be in English. Latin.
This is all these people just go there's an entire group. There's a lot of Francoists who sort of go ape.
One of my favorite things about Catholicism is when you get these Vatican II conspiracies where the church is literally well, our religion's dying because nobody understands what the fuck is going on in these services and stuff. Perhaps we could slightly modernize it so that people understand what's being said.
These guys think the Pope is Jewish. They literally think this. It is
classic Jewish person, the Pope.
Yeah, it's this whole thing. And so the Tecos are they're a death squad, right? They kill people, kill students. And the League comes to them and are like, hey, you guys are anti-Semites. You guys are death squads. Go find other anti-communist death squads in Latin America and recruit them so we can talk to them. And they do. These guys are literally, they're football talent scouts, but for death squads.
Well, that's good. I mean, yeah. Look, you know how I feel about death squats, Chris. If you're not getting the good, like somewhere out there is the LeBron James of killing a lot of people and pushing their bodies into a crudely dug pit. And if you don't find him, you know, another death squad's going to get him. And then you're not going to win the Sophie. What is the basketball award for good at basketball?
MVP.
Yeah, you're not going to win the MVP. So.
Yeah, look, you got it. Well, the other thing, again, is this is very important, right?
Robert's because, so proud of himself. You don't the thank smirk you. He's giving thank is you. So cool.
Thank you, Sophie.
It's about time you took an interest in one of my hobbies.
Mm-hmm. I'm learning. It's a real Heisman Trophy day for the Death Squad people.
No.
Oh, well,
okay, okay. I'm going to turn this to a baseball metaphor, which is that, okay, so the other thing that's happening here, right, is that you have to build up your roster, right? And you have to build up sure. your sort of like your minor league system. You have to do this so that you can train other death squads. And these guys are about to become the fucking 90s Mariners of building up death squads. They have a bullpen so deep they can fucking like they can kick out literal Hall of Fame power hitters because they don't need more hitting. They have so many death squads. And
who's the Wade Boggs of death squads in this period? By which I mean who is drinking 70 beers on a flight from I don't know, Stockholm to Smolensk.
Oh, what is this guy named Jomo? Oh God, I can't remember his last name.
Yeah.
It's that guy who hilariously kind of isn't going to come up. There's a lot of people who did a lot of assassinations who are in the league who we're not going to talk about because they're like just D-listers.
Yeah,
there's so many. So the thing about the CAL is that they're very quietly one of the most important organizations in the history of the Latin American Cold War. And almost nobody's ever heard of them. But one of the things that they do is in 1973. So these meetings, right, you get a bunch of death squads showing up to it and you get a bunch of countries like sending their intelligence services to these meetings to go like talk about with other countries and tell like right wing anti-communist intelligence services. And in one of these meetings in 1973, the dictatorships of Brazil and Paraguay agree to exchange information and sort of like coordinate security measures to the CIL. Now, Paraguay at this point is ruled by Alfredo Stroessner, who is one of the World Anti-Communist League's biggest supporters, the man, like, this guy, like, personally hosts several World Anti-Communist League conferences. He also, like, he sold eight-year-olds into sex slavery. The worst thing that he does is, he does this genocide against the indigenous Aché population. I'm going to read from the Washington Post in 1977. And, by the way, when I read this thing, you have to understand, this is from 1977. There are like 20 more years of the genocide that are going to happen after this. Quote, 50% of the Aché population living in Paraguay since in 1968 have since disappeared.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. And, you know, where did they go? Well, okay, they got raped, tortured, and murdered by settlers who were doing a genocide and to take their land. There are these Aché hunters whose job is literally to go out and kidnap Aché people and, like, force them to live on these, like, reservations, quote unquote, on their farms. Like they're doing slave raids, they're selling children, they're forcing
that
people
seems
into
like
slavery.
Somebody should stop that, Chris.
Yeah, like no
that
one
seems
ever
like
does
somebody should
no
deal
one
with
ever
that.
Does like this okay. this goes on that's for the like good. The entire 30 years of like the Stroessner dictatorship.
Okay.
And now in 1973 Stroessner starts coordinating his police suppression with the Brazilian dictatorship through the CAL. The next year the CAL's coordinating council meets in Rio de Janeiro. The coordinating council, it has representatives from Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, Paraguay, Uruguay, and also has a bunch of Cuban exiles. Okay, so you know what are they doing there? This is from the book Predatory States. The purpose of the meeting was to receive information and to exchange experiences concerning communists and pro-communists in order to adapt methods that could be applied throughout the continent. It was important because one of the main resolutions sought to establish a system to exchange confidential information among member nations. Now, people who know your sort of like Cold War Latin American history are starting to perk up right now because if you studied like this stuff, that list sounds really familiar, and it should be. There's a couple of allies thrown into the list, but those are the countries that are involved in Operation Condor. And that meeting of the World Anti-Communist League's Latin American affiliate, the CAL, was one of the first steps towards setting up the Condor system. The next year, there's a more official meeting, but there's a meeting of intelligence services from Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay to sort of expand cooperation further. And, you know, this turns into Condor. So All right. What is Operation Condor? The last two quotes that I sort of pulled are from this book called Predatory States, Operation Condor and Covert War in Latin America. It's a very good book. I recommend people read it. It was written by a Long Island University political science professor named J. Pertice McSherry. And I'm going to like use the intro that she uses to this, which is describing what happened to a guy named Martin Almada, who's the guy who writes the foreword to the book. Just to give you a sense of what this stuff actually looks like. In 1974, Martin Almada was dragged out of his house in Paraguay in the middle of the night by our friend Alfredo Stroessner, after which he was tortured for 30 days for, quote, intellectual terrorism. No. And intellectual terrorism, well, so they bring him in and they're trying to figure out what he did, right? And the only thing this guy did was he was like a leader in a teacher's union and he was like using the teaching methods of Pablo Fieri. Mm-hmm. And so for this, they torture him. They force his wife to listen to his screams over the phone for 10 days. And then they told her that he'd been killed, at which point his wife dies from a heart attack.
Oh.
And yeah.
I don't like that.
No.
I don't like that story.
Yeah.
I don't like that story at all.
And the other thing that's interesting about, okay, so in some sense, right, like this is a thing that military dictatorships do. But
those wacky military dictatorships all, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, like normally when you get kidnapped by a dictatorship, right, there's a bunch of soldiers and like spooks from your country.
Right.
When this guy
gets
captured.
That's always been my experience when I've been kidnapped by a military dictatorship. So I can tell you.
It's dictatorship in one country. But when this guy gets kidnapped, there's military attaches from Argentina, from Brazil, from Bolivia, from Chile, and from Uruguay. And eventually, Almada gets released from prison after like this giant hunger strike and this huge Amnesty International campaign. And he starts trying to figure out what the fuck happened to him. And it turns out that Martin Almada and his wife have become very early victims of Operation Condor.
Aw, they're ground trailblazers.
Yeah, and do you know who else were victims of Operation Condor? No one.
The products and services that support this podcast?
Exactly zero of those. They almost certainly
the
all supported this.
That's who supports our podcast.
Man, if only the Ustashi had been the target of Operation Condor, we would all live in a better world.
No, but instead they're big into the podcast game and you know, there are major backers of the island where will let you hunt children for sport and for food.
Yeah.
And for food. It's unethical just to hunt kids for trophies. You know, got to cook them. Brisket.
Oh, God. The one was unethical.
Sophie, that's the ad. I'm just reading the ad as it was sent to us by the and the Ustashi people. Okay.
Is the promo code with how many M's?
Good.
That's at least 9 M's.
Yeah. Okay. Here's the ads. Robert Evans here, and as a kid, I loved playing Monopoly, but my favorite thing about it was robbing the bank, you know, working with my friends to pull over a con on somebody else, even heisting their money sometimes. And now Monopoly Go brings that fun to your phone. It's one of those games that can bring out the most devious version of ourselves. You can bankrupt your friends by pulling heists on their vaults and even use a wrecking ball to shut down their monuments. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with your friends to unlock prizes or try to top the leaderboards. And whether you're working with somebody or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is a huge blast. Go download it now for free on the App Store or Google Play.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Oh, boy, we're back.
You know, I'm not going to...
Robert.
No segue. I'm immediately just going to read a description of how Condor
don't
worked.
Ever do that voice again. That was uncomfortable. Please continue.
Sophie.
Hated it.
Hi. Hello.
What's up?
How are you?
Good. You?
How's it going?
Great. Chris, good take times. Over, please.
The Condor system consisted of three levels. The first was mutual cooperation among military intelligence services to coordinate political surveillance of targeted dissidents and exchange intelligence information. The second was covert action, a form of offensive unconventional warfare in which the role of the Predator remains concealed. Multinational Condor squadrons carried out covert cross-border operations to detain, disappear, exiles, and transfer them to their countries of origin where most disappeared permanently. Third and most secret level was Condor's assassination capability, known as Phase 3. Under Phase 3, special teams of assassins from member countries were formed to travel worldwide to eliminate subversive enemies. Phase 3 was aimed at political leaders especially feared for their potential to mobilize world opinion or organize broad opposition to the military states. So, what Condor is, right, is a bunch of countries, it's Chile, Paraguay, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Ecuador, and later Peru, working together to form just, like, multinational death squads and using them to, like, they have these death squads and kidnapping teams, and they use them to target, like, internal enemies and subversives who, it turns out, is just literally anyone who doesn't support the government. I'm going to read a quote from an operative of DINA, which is Pinochet's National Intelligence Directorate, which is, like, they're, like, the secret police, but also the CIA.
Oh, good.
They're great. And by great,
yeah,
they
sound like cool guys.
Yeah. Right. One DIMNA operative explained DINA's strategy as follows. First, the aim was to stop terrorism. Then possible extremists were targeted, and later those who might be converted into extremists. Similar language was used in 1977 by Argentine General Iberico St. Jean when he said, "First, we kill all the subversives, then we kill all their collaborators, then their sympathizers, then all those who remain indifferent."
Maybe take notes on that, people who remain indifferent.
Yeah, they're going to kill you too. Like, unless you are an active supporter of the regime and also you never piss anyone off ever somehow miraculously, they're going to kill you too. It's great. And this works on two levels. On the one side, there's these internal purges, right, which are aided by intelligence from other Condor countries. So, for example, in 1976, the Argentinian army, like, stages a coup and takes control of the country. And they start what's known as the Dirty War, in which the government disappears 30,000 people who become known as desaparecidos. One of the fun tactics of the Argentinian army and their death squads was to keep pregnant women alive just long enough to force them to have their babies and then kill them and steal the babies, which...
Okay, that doesn't sound like good behavior. Sure.
Yeah, and all of these guys are right-wing Catholics, and I'm not even going to bother spelling out the comparison to fourth birthers in the U.S. I will leave that metaphor as an exercise for the listener. And these killings were done, like, partly they're done directly by the state, and partly they're done by state-supported death squads. In Argentina, that death squad is called the Argentine Anti-Communist Alliance, or AAA. Here's McSherry again.
Oh, is it the same AAA that helps me when I need my car towed?
Yes.
You know, I genuinely can't tell. I think the quote I'm about to read, they're making a AAA joke, but I'm not entirely sure.
I'm going to say yes, just based on the long lines that you have to stand in that place.
I buy it.
Mm-hmm.
In November 1973, the AAA detonated a bomb in the car of Senator Hipólito Yrigoyen. That's a gnarly name. Of the Unión Cívica Radical, which is hilariously a moderate party, its first claimed terrorist attack. The senator was severely wounded. He was the victim of another bomb in 1975 and was tortured and interrogated by army officers in that year. They told him, quote, "You want to know about the AAA? Well, we're the AAA. We put the bomb in your car."
Oh, well, that's nice of them to say so.
Yeah. It's also worth noting, so the AAA, they get kind of absorbed into the Argentinian military, but they kind of still operate under the, it's, I don't know, after the military coup in 76, they're more inside the state than they are outside of it. But they also host a 1980 meeting of the CIL in Buenos Aires after they were sort of semi-absorbed. They're also heavily involved in the One Anti-Communist League, and we're going to come back to that 1980 meeting because it also was very important, but that'll be for next episode. For now, we should talk about like how Condor actually worked a bit more. McSherry describes it as a parastatal organization, in that it's technically inside or tied to the state, but it operates completely in secret. And it has a unified command structure that involves operatives from, you know, intelligence services, from the military. There's cops, there's right wing civilians and paramilitaries. But again, like the secrecy of this means that even other parts of the military don't know that they exist. As we've seen with AAA, Condor makes use of paramilitary, sometimes like folding them directly in the chain of command. Sometimes they just like basically do contract killings out to other like fascist paramilitaries. And their whole command structure remains entirely unregistered. It is by its very nature outside of the sort of bounds of the state bureaucracy. Everything is unmarked, untagged, secret, or black ops. Its officers are commissioned literally as special agents. It operates as a sort of like a secret parallel state alongside the official state. And I want to pause here for a second to think about the extent to which American and British pop culture is entirely centered around valorizing this stuff. Like, pop culture is completely obsessed with secret agents. There's 25 Bond movies. There are 5 different Call of Duty Black Ops games, right? Like, the last Black Ops game is literally you working for Ronald Reagan to do stuff for the CIA. But it's like, okay, if you think about what this stuff is, right? All of this Black Ops stuff, it's this, you know, you look at the sort of purest expression of it in Latin America. It's literally just this tyrannical parallel state whose job it is to kill subversives. And it's the Death Squad machine. And it's like, this is our entire pop culture is about making everyone think the Death Squad machine is cool.
Well, but the Death Squad machine is drunk all the time. And that's pretty neat.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I went to university and I therefore know that you can be drunk all the time without being a Death Squad.
We had very different college experiences, but that's a story for another day, am I right?
Hey. I mean, admittedly, we are on our like third college paramilitary in this episode, so
that's right. That's yeah. right. Just like how
don't do it.
John Sportsman.
You were doing basketball. So well. We were so proud of you.
Yeah, it was like 4 for 4.
Touchback, first down?
No.
3-pointer.
Oh, no.
Nailed it. Uh-huh.
So, all right, we now have a picture. We have a incredibly lackluster picture of the nature of basketball. We have a better picture of the internal structure of Condor. But the thing is, Condor is a multinational operation, and a huge part of it is doing what the modern CIA would call extraordinary renditions. And this means that they're just like kidnapping dissidents who, for example, fled from Chile to Paraguay, and then you bring them back to Chile and then you torture and execute them. And as this program, you know, goes on, they start assassinating people like all over the world. And these people, you know, they're not just getting murdered, right? They're getting horribly tortured. The bodies that people find are like heavily mutilated. They're stab wounds. They're heavily burned. The Argentinian classic is just dropping people both dead and alive out of helicopters. And
well, at least they're not discriminating between dead or alive.
That's true.
Everybody gets dropped out of a helicopter. That's equality. Yeah.
And, you know, and the other thing is they're not just killing like completely random, like nobody or like, you know, incredibly minor activists. They're killing people who are like very high profile and very famous. Like in 1976, they killed the former president of Bolivia, Juan José Torres, in Buenos Aires. And, you know, one of the favorite tactics that they use for sort of getting away with this stuff is that they'll kill a bunch of people and then blame it on the left murdering each other. But, like, that's not actually enough to cover up, we killed the president of Bolivia.
Well, we killed the president of Italy, too, but nobody has a problem with that.
We will get to that. Actually, I will mention it and then pointedly not explain it next episode.
That's good. That's good. You want to learn more about the assassination of the fucking prime minister of Italy? Just listen to Alex Jones's show the next time Steve Pachinik is back on, because he's the one who did it.
You can hear from an ex. Well, okay. To
frequent
be fair,
InfoWars contributor, the guy who killed the prime minister of Italy.
To be fair, There are a lot of people who were involved in killing the prime minister. Steve Bochenek the whole credit
for
that.
It's a team role.
The KGB was involved.
It's not just magic and Biggie. Tom Cruise, someone who was else on the team, Sophie?
Are you trying to make a Magic Johnson Larry Bird reference right now?
That's the one, Larry Bird. Lawrence Bird.
To be fair, I'm okay with you fucking up his name.
Magic Johnson and Larry Flint. Heroes.
Very okay with you fucking up his name. Go for it. Call him whatever you want.
Good. All right. Back to the game.
So, okay. You know, it is incredible. Like, it is so obvious that, like, people that, like, there's something going on here that's assassinating people that, like, even journalists are just starting to write articles that are like, yeah, there's probably something going on here. And so, Robert, you might be asking yourself, what is the United States, the champion of democracy and human rights, and the leader of the free world, doing about a bunch of death squads murdering anyone who doesn't actively support a military dictatorship? And the answer is, sometimes they write a few strongly worded letters. They do this, like, twice. They write a few strongly worded letters. Mostly, they do nothing. And then the other part of the time, they're actively helping them do it. So to get a sense of, like, the level of impunity that Condor had from the U.S. government, the political counselor of the U.S. embassy in Ecuador, in Uruguay, you know, did the right thing for once. And they figure out that a Brazilian labor leader is about to be, like, kidnapped and assassinated by these guys. And he helps this guy escape. And in retaliation, a bunch of dudes in ski masks grabbed him off the street and broke every vertebrae in his neck and back. And again, this guy works for the U.S. embassy, and they broke every single vertebrae in his neck and upper back. And the U.S. does nothing.
What would you expect us to do?
Okay, so, like, every once in a while, you'll do... One of the things that happens with the Iran-Contra, right, is that they accidentally get a DEA agent killed. And after that, the U.S. just goes, like, absolute ape shit, like... It's just like, okay, but this guy is an embassy guy. You'd think that, like, if you almost kill a guy from your embassy, like, something would happen. But, like, no, it doesn't happen at all.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And speaking of the government doing nothing, in 1976, agents of the Chilean National Intelligence Directorate working with right-wing Cuban exiles from the CIL, car bomb a man named Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C., Letier had been the socialist foreign minister under Allende, and he's this, like, implacable foe of Pinochet. And the Chileans are like, yeah, we'll just kill him. And so, you know, they do it, right? They just, they kill him in the, like, literally in Washington, D.C. with a car bomb. And the guy who does it is an American DINA operative named Michael Townley. And he serves 5 years in prison and then gets FBI witness protection.
Oh, wow.
So, There are an enormous number of people in this country who have served more time in prison for literally having weed than this guy is serving for doing a car bomb assassination in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and that seems. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. And this is like during the Carter administration. Do it. Nothing happens. Just nothing. I think it's during the Carter administration. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. 76. Yeah. And the reason they don't do anything is twofold. One is that the CIA is systematically lying under oath to Congress about what it knew about Condor. And the other reason is that the U.S. is actively helping them. There's two channels to this. One is that there's good evidence that the CIA actively helped the Chilean government kidnap and murder multiple American citizens. But it's actually much worse than that, because so Condor, as a sort of network, is running off of this encrypted American telecommunication network and equipment that is based in the Panama Canal Zone. Now, Robert, I'm going to ask you, what was the U.S. government running in the Panama Canal Zone in the 1970s?
They were just helping boats. You know, they love boats. We're big boat people, America, and we like to keep them moving. That was fine.
What was the other thing we were running there?
Just boats.
Just
mostly
boats.
Just boats. Yeah, just boats. There was a guy named Manuel Noriega who was famous because he was good at boats.
Yeah. We also
not cocaine. Just boats.
We also have a very famous boating school there called the School of the America. It trains
Olympic athletes.
That's a great
place to learn how to boat. If you want to learn how to be on a boat, school of the, because it's the school of how to, like, take your boat across the Americas. That's why they call it the School of the Americas.
Yeah.
All of the Americas is for boats.
Yeah. So,
anyway.
So yeah, that's right, baby. It's the School of the Americas. We're doing the School of the Americas again. And it turns out that I'm just going to read this from Predatory States. As one military graduate of the School of Americas put it, the school was always a front for other special operations, covert operations. So they're using the School of the Americas as cover to run a covert assassination network that's going to kill like an incredible number of people, including multiple U.S. citizens, some of whom were killed on American soil. It's great.
Yeah, that's like, I don't know what that's like. Something basketball.
You know, and that's just where
thumbs down that, from Sophie on that one.
On that terrible basketball metaphor, that's where we're going to leave it today, with the World Anti-Communist League having helped spawn and carry out Operation Condor alongside their friends, the CIA.
Well, if your friend is the CIA, you can find the rest of our shows on the internet.
At Cool Zone Media.
You know what? Actually, we should do a little bit of house cleaning here, because folks have been yelling about this on a couple of different things.
Go for it.
So people are always like, hey, there's some weird edit thing, or there's some clip or something is wrong here. And I have to tell you all right now, none of that has to do with us. It has to do with like whatever fucking weird ass app you're using.
And usually it's Spotify.
It's Spotify, or it's fucking Podcast Republic, or like Podfucker, or whatever goddamn bespoke ass pod app you motherfuckers use. Just fucking use an RSS feed. Anyway, whatever. People are weird. I don't know what to tell them. But there's really nothing particularly that we can do.
I can give you some advice. Can I give some advice?
Yes, Sophie.
If you notice that your thing is being funky on Spotify, delete it. Refresh your feed. Re-download it.
If the episode sounds fucked up, instead of hopping online and assuming that it's us, hop onto your phone, delete it, re-download it, and it'll probably be fine. Because here's the thing. This show gets downloaded like 10 million times a month on like 1,000 different goddamn apps, and like that just introduces a lot of different ways for things to get all fucky in weird ways. And we do our best with quality control, but we have no control over like podcast cum guzzler or whatever app you like to use. So, you know, try re-downloading the show before you yell at Sophie on the internet about how, the podomy app, that was sodomy and pod that I mixed together.
I liked it.
Isn't working right. Okay. It's fine. I do love it when people are like, hey, do you know why your podcasts are fucked up? And then they'll just like name some app I've never heard of. And it's like, I don't know. Maybe it's because you're using some weird goddamn app I've never heard of to download a fucking podcast. What do you want from us? We don't even know how many apps are out there people are using to download our fucking shows.
And everyone is like, my audio is skipping. Yeah, that's Spotify. Mm-hmm. You can't see it, but I'm smiling on the outside while dying on the inside like a winner. Speaking of winners, Chris, where can people follow you?
You can find me at itmechr3 on Twitter. Yeah, that's it. Don't look for me anywhere else. You won't find me.
Yeah. Cool. And look for me behind you whenever you feel afraid, because that's where I'll be, stealing your wallet.
I'm ending it on that.
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news, with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts, as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.